We thought we were the only thinking beings in the universe until we met you. But never did we dream that thought could arise from the lonely animals who cannot dream each other's dreams. How were we to know we could live with you in peace? Believe us. Believe us. Believe us. He reached into the cavity and took out the cocoon. It was astonishingly light, to hold all the hope and future of a great race within it. "I'll carry you," said Ender. "I'll go from world to world until I find a time and a place where you can come awake in safety. And I'll tell your story to my people, so that perhaps in time they can forgive you too, the way that you've forgiven me." He wrapped the queen's cocoon in his jacket and carried her from the tower. "What was in there?" asked Abra. "The answer," said Ender. "To what?" "My question." And that was all he said of the matter. They searched for 5 more days and chose a site for the colony far to the east and south of the tower. Weeks later, he came to Valentine and told her to read something he had written. She pulled the file he named from the ship's computer and read it. It was written as if the Hive Queen spoke, telling all that they had meant to do and all that they had done. "Here are our failures, and here is our greatness. We did not mean to hurt you, and we forgive you for our death. From their earliest awareness to the great wars that swept across their home world, Ender told the story quickly, as if it were ancient memory. When he came to the tale of the Great Mother, the Queen of All, who first learned to keep and teach the new queen instead of killing her or driving her away, then he lingered, telling how many times she had, finally, to destroy the child of her body, the new self that was not herself, until she bore one who understood her quest for harmony. This was a new thing in the world, 2 queens that loved and helped each other instead of battling, and together they were stronger than any other hive. They prospered. They had more daughters who joined them in peace. It was the beginning of wisdom. "If only we could have talked to you," the Hive Queen said in Ender's words. "But since it could not be, we ask only this, that you remember us not as enemies, but as tragic sisters, changed into a foul shape by fate or God or evolution. If we had kissed, it would have been the miracle to make us human in each other's eyes. Instead, we killed each other. But still, we welcome you now as guest friends. Come into our home, daughters of Earth. Dwell in our tunnels. Harvest our fields. What we cannot do, you are now our hands to do for us. Blossom, trees. Ripen, fields. Be warm for them, suns. Be fertile for them, planets. They are our adopted daughters, and they have come home." The book that Ender wrote was not long, but in it was all the good and all the evil that the Hive Queen knew. And he signed it, not with his name, but with a title: Speaker for the Dead. On Earth, the book was published quietly, and quietly it was passed from hand to hand until it was hard to believe that anyone on Earth might not have read it. Most who read it found it interesting. Some who read it refused to set it aside. They began to live by it as best they could, and when their loved ones died, a believer would arise beside the grave to be the speaker for the dead and say what the dead one would have said, but with full candor, hiding no faults and pretending no virtues. Those who came to such services sometimes found them painful and disturbing, but there were many who decided that their life was worthwhile enough, despite their errors, that when they died, a speaker should tell the truth for them. On Earth, it remained a religion among many religions, but for those who traveled the great cave of space and lived their lives in the Hive Queen's tunnels and harvested the Hive Queen's fields, it was the only religion. There was no colony without its speaker for the dead. No one knew, and no one really wanted to know, who was the original speaker. Ender was not inclined to tell them. When Valentine was 25 years old, she finished the last volume of her History of the Bugger Wars. She included at the end the complete text of Ender's little book, but did not say that Ender wrote it. By Ansible, she got an answer from the ancient hegemon, Peter Wiggin. 77 years old with a failing heart.
"I know who wrote it," he said. "If he can speak for the buggers, surely he can speak for me."
Back and forth across the Ansible, Ender and Peter spoke, with Peter pouring out the story of his days and years, his crimes and his kindnesses. And when he died, Ender wrote a second volume, again signed by the Speaker for the Dead. Together, his two books were called The Hive Queen and The Hegemon, and they were holy writ. "Come on," he said to Valentine one day. "Let's fly away and live forever." "We can't," she said. "There are miracles even relativity can't pull off, Ender. We have to go. I'm almost happy here. So stay. I've lived too long with pain. I won't know who I am without it." So they boarded a starship and went from world to world. Wherever they stopped, he was always Andrew Wiggin, itinerant speaker for the dead, and she was always Valentine, historian errant, writing down the stories of the living while Ender spoke the stories of the dead. And always Ender carried with him a dry, white cocoon, looking for the world where the Hive Queen could awaken and thrive in peace. He looked a long time.
A postscript, Orson Scott Card.
So, it's been 20 years since Ender's Game was first published as a hardcover novel. Of course, for me, it's been a lot longer than that. It was a short story, originally, a novelette, according to the technical definition, that came out in the August 1977 issue of Analog. But let's go back even further than that. It was 1967 when I first came up with the idea of writing Ender's Game, of the story of Ender's Game. My older brother Bill was dating a girl named Laura Dean Lowe, who later, of course, became Mrs. Bill Card. And at the time, she was an avid science fiction reader. Bill was interested in science fiction also. And she introduced him to the Foundation trilogy. And knowing that I also was somewhat interested in science fiction, they gave me the first and third volumes, Foundation, that's what it is, and then Second Foundation by Isaac Asimov. They weren't able to pick up the middle book. But Isaac Asimov's magnum opus was wonderful for me. It was illuminating. I hadn't read science fiction in several years at that point, and not on a regular basis. And I plunged into that book, and it came to life for me. I've always admired Asimov. I still admire him as probably the finest writer of English prose in the American tradition, the plain tradition, where you don't have highly decorated and highly figured speech, but instead the narration is as clean and clear and the author is as invisible as possible. And as I read the Foundation trilogy, I came to realize that this is something that I really would like to do myself. I often tell young writers that there are two reasons for becoming a writer. One of them is you read something wonderful and you say, "Oh, wow, I want to be able to write like that." The other reason is you read something absolutely awful and you say, "Man, if that got published, I can write." Well, I always tell people that my motive for starting out as a writer was the latter. And it's really true. When I actually practically started writing, when I actually started setting words down on paper in a serious way, it was because I had seen some plays that I thought were pretty awful, and I thought, if that can be put on, I can write plays. And so I started doing it, and they were put on, and that was the beginning of my writing career. But my interest in becoming a writer actually was prompted by the first motive. And it was reading Isaac Asimov that made me think, I'd like to be able to do that. I'd like to be able to tell stories that can make people feel the way I feel when I'm reading Asimov's Foundation trilogy. So I set myself the task, then in 1967, I was 16 years old, set myself the task of figuring out what a good science fiction story would be. Now, at the time, the Vietnam War was on, and my brother Bill was in the military. In fact, he was stationed at Fort Douglas while he was dating Laura Dean, and he was recovering from a broken leg that happened while he was riding bikes with me and my younger brother, Russell, while Bill was on leave from the military. So he had already served in Korea for a while, and now he was stationed in Salt Lake City, close at hand. But I had been aware of all of his training. He had gone through basic training and had been an outstanding private in that setting. In fact, so outstanding that they moved him on to Officer's Candidate School. But he washed himself out. He chose not to continue there because to him it just made no sense that they would try to train somebody to be an officer by breaking his will and treating him really badly. He felt like they should be treating them well and helping them to rely on their own sense of initiative. So he felt like it was a counterproductive training program, and from what he said, I believed it absolutely. So the issue of training, what good training would be, what bad training would be, was strongly in my mind. And I must confess also, of course, at the age of 16, I was only a year and a half, couple of years maybe away from being draft age at 18. And that had to, play a role in my thinking.